Welcome to this custom deep dive. Today, we're tackling a really dense period of federal activity. The title we've put on this is The Federal News Update for Wednesday, October 22nd, 2025.
That's right. We've essentially gone through everything with a fine-tooth comb, every significant government action, policy shift, personnel move, starting from Tuesday morning, October 21st, right through today, the 22nd.
I'm Alex Johnson. And with me to unpack all of this, the policy details, the politics, and some frankly surprising bureaucratic moves, is our expert analyst, Sam Kennedy.
Thanks. And our goal today, like you said, is really granular. We want to track every key action, every signature on a proclamation, and really dig into what it means right now, the immediate implications. This is the deep dive.
And the backdrop is just impossible to ignore. We're seeing this stark contrast, aren't we? On one hand, you have Congress completely gridlocked. This government shutdown is dragging into its fourth week, day 22 now.
Right, day 22. And then on the other hand, you see the executive branch acting with, well, incredible speed and decisiveness, major actions, international agreements. It's quite the juxtaposition.
That contrast, chaos versus control, almost seems like the best way to understand what's happening. The legislative branch is broken, but the executive is projecting this immense strength.
Exactly. And maybe even using that legislative paralysis as a cover, or at least an opportunity, to push through some pretty significant institutional changes.
Okay, let's start with that paralysis then, the shutdown. Day 22 is a grim milestone. It's now the second longest in history. But more than that, you said it's the longest full government shutdown. What's the practical difference there?
That's a really critical distinction. Some of the past long shutdowns, like back in 2018, 2019, were partial. Large parts of the government kept running. This time, it's a full shutdown because the appropriations bills for almost every major department just expired, except for maybe a few core security functions.
So the sheer number of services affected, the number of federal workers furloughed, it's much broader this time for this duration.
Unprecedented for a shutdown of this length, yes. The scale is just different.
And the economic damage isn't just theoretical anymore. It's showing up at the numbers, or at least the estimates.
It absolutely is. You're hearing warnings from economists pretty much across the board now. They're estimating the shutdown shaves off somewhere between 0.1 to 0.2 percentage points from annualized GDP growth every single week.
So 4 weeks in, that's starting to be a real drag on the economy, especially heading into the holiday season.
Precisely. And it's not just abstract GDP figures. It's hitting specific sectors hard. Look at the Small Business Administration loans. They've basically stopped.
How much are we talking about there?
The estimate is around $860 million per week. That just vanishes from the pipeline.
Wow. And what does that mean for the businesses relying on those loans?
Well, that $860 million translates to roughly 1,600 small businesses every week. These could be startups, local shops trying to expand, contractors needing capital. They count on that SBA backing. When the underwriting halts, the loans just freeze or disappear entirely.
And if you're a small business running on tight margins, a few weeks delay, that could be fatal.
It really could. It might mean missing payroll, delaying critical orders, maybe even closing down for good. The ripple effect is significant.
There's also an impact on housing, right?
Yeah.
Something about flood insurance.
Yeah, it's less traumatic maybe, but still critical, especially in certain areas. The shutdown means the government isn't issuing or renewing federal flood insurance policies.
And lenders require that insurance in flood zones.
Exactly. So if you're trying to close on a house or refinance in a designated floodplain, and you can't get that policy renewed or issued because FEMA is largely shut down, the deal stalls. It creates bottlenecks in the real estate market, particularly coastal states, places prone to flooding.
What makes this even trickier, though, is that we're kind of flying blind economically because of the data blackout.
That's another insidious effect. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, parts of the Census Bureau, Commerce Department, they're shut down. So all that vital economic data, the monthly jobs report, inflation numbers like the CPI, retail sales figures, it's just not coming out.
So the Federal Reserve, investors, businesses making plans, they're operating in the dark.
Pretty much. It dramatically increases uncertainty. How can the Fed make informed decisions about interest rates without reliable inflation or employment data? How can businesses plan investments? It's a major problem.
Okay, so with all this pressure building, how did the political blame game and strategy play out over the last, say, 48 hours?
Well, it was intense. On Tuesday, October 21st, President Trump had Senate Republicans over for lunch. He held it near the West Wing patio in a spot he's apparently started calling the Rose Garden Club.
A bit theatrical.
Perhaps. But the purpose was clear. Project Unity reinforced the message.
And that message was squarely aimed at the Democrats.
Absolutely. The public statements afterwards hammered Democrats, specifically Leader Schumer, for, quote, obstructing by not voting for the clean bipartisan CR.
The continuing resolution that would fund the government temporarily?
Right. The Republican line is very sharp. Democrats are holding the government hostage,
yeah.
And they've put a price tag on it, a $1.5 trillion ransom, they call it, for wasteful spending demands.
So simplifying the complex negotiations down to that one figure.
Exactly. It's a clear political message.
But the Democrats have their own clear message, right? Focused on health care.
They do. Their core demand, the reason they say they're holding out, is the need to negotiate extending the enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies. Those extra subsidies are set to expire December 31st of this year, 2025.
So the timing makes this urgent. It's not some abstract future problem.
Not at all. Insurers are setting their rates for 2026 right now. They have to assume those enhanced subsidies will expire if nothing changes.
Which means premiums are projected to spike.
Massively, yes. For millions of people who buy insurance on the ACA marketplaces. So Schumer and House Minority Leader Jeffries specifically requested a meeting with the president on Tuesday to, quote, resolve the health care crisis. They're trying to directly link the shutdown to people's health care costs.
And the president's response.
His position is firm. Reopen the government first, then we can talk about health care. He sees it as a separate legislative fight, not something to be negotiated under the duress of a shutdown.
Meanwhile, what are the Republicans in Congress planning? Are they just waiting for Democrats to fold?
Well, GOP leaders are acknowledging the current CR deadline, November 21st, might be too soon to resolve this. So they're already planning for possibly needing a new, maybe longer, continuing resolution to keep things funded whenever they do reopen.
And the House strategy under Speaker Johnson? He kept the House in recess today, Wednesday?
Yes. No floor activity at all on the 22nd. And that seems deliberate. It's a pressure tactic.
How so? By making it look like the Senate is the only obstacle?
Partly that, yes. Put all the focus, all the blame on Senate Democrats. It also projects this image of, well, the House did its job, we passed clean funding bills, now we wait for the Senate.
But it also risks looking like the House is just not working during a crisis.
That's the risk, definitely. Some moderate Republicans have voiced that concern. It could backfire if the public sees it as simply refusing to engage while federal services are shut down.
And inside this whole mess, there's a fight brewing over federal workers' pay, specifically back pay.
Right. This gets complicated. Senate Republicans pushed for a vote this week to pay only the military members and those federal employees deemed essential who are still working through the shutdown.
What's the strategy there?
It looks like an attempt to split the Democrats, force them into a tough vote. Do they vote against paying the military and essential workers if the bill doesn't also include the furloughed workers?
And the Democratic counter move.
Senators Van Hollen and Peters are working on their own bill. Theirs would guarantee pay for all federal workers essential and furloughed. Their argument is simple. No federal employee should be used as a pawn or punished because of political dysfunction.
This whole debate about who gets paid during the shutdown actually shines a light on a potentially huge legal fight happening behind the scenes, doesn't it? Something about the back pay guarantee itself.
This is really important, buried in some filings. The Office of Management and Budget, OMB, is challenging the interpretation of the Government Employee Fair Treatment Act. That's the 2019 law that supposedly guarantees back pay after shutdowns.
The one President Trump actually signed, it seemed pretty clear. What's OMB arguing?
They're focusing on specific wording in the law. The phrase, subject to enactment of appropriations. OMB is claiming this means the back pay isn't automatic. They argue Congress has to pass a new separate law specifically authorizing the back pay each time there's a shutdown, even after the government reopens with regular funding.
Wow. So they're saying the original law is basically meaningless without a second act of Congress for every single shutdown.
That's their interpretation. They're saying the guarantee is conditional on a specific post-shutdown appropriation for back pay.
And federal employee unions must be furious.
Absolutely livid. Groups like Narrower FE, the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association, are pushing back hard. They argue subject to enactment of appropriations just means the money has to come from somewhere. Congress approves, like, the bill that reopens the government, not that a whole separate back pay bill is needed every time.
What are the stakes if OMB's interpretation holds?
It would be a fundamental shift. It would mean federal workers are no longer guaranteed to be made whole after a shutdown. That removes a massive incentive for Congress to actually resolve these standoffs quickly. It turns a temporary hardship for workers into potentially permanent lost wages.
A huge potential change hanging on just a few words of legalese.
Exactly. The implications for future budget fights are enormous.
Okay, so that's the legislative chaos. Let's pivot to that executive control side you mentioned. We saw a flurry of major presidential proclamations filed late Tuesday, published today.
Yes. Three big ones. It felt very coordinated, timed to project decisiveness while Congress has stalled, create that split-screen effect. D.C. gridlock versus White House action.
First up, Proclamation 1886, National Energy Dominance Month, 2025. The theme seems pretty clear from the title.
Oh, yeah. No subtlety there. It's a full-throated reaffirmation of maximizing fossil fuel production. It uses that slogan, drill, baby, drill. The proclamation formally names October as the month, but more importantly, it explicitly reaffirms policies like rolling back regulations and, significantly, opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, ANWR, for drilling leases.
So it's more than just symbolic. It's locking in policy.
It's codifying an approach. It signals very clearly domestically and internationally that energy production, specifically fossil fuels, takes precedence over climate change concerns in this administration's view. It aims to embed that deregulation strategy.
Then there was Proclamation 1985 about National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. What stood out there?
This one focused on foreign threats and securing technology supply chains. It pointed to a recent executive order mandating secure software development practices for government systems and promoting strong encryption. It also gave a nod to the First Lady's initiative on the Take It Down Act,
which deals with online exploitation.
Right, things like non-consensual deepfakes and other forms of online abuse. But interestingly, the language in the proclamation also hinted at a potential shift in focus for AI regulation.
How so?
It seemed to subtly pivot away from concerns about platforms censoring lawful speech, which has been a major focus for conservatives, and more towards using AI policy to target specific security threats and criminal exploitation. It might signal a new direction for regulating online content, focusing government efforts narrowly rather than on broad platform moderation rules.
Interesting nuance. And the third proclamation, 1984, seems like the most immediately impactful economically. It adjusts imports of certain vehicles.
Yeah, this one is big. It imposes major tariffs on imported medium and heavy-duty vehicles. Think big trucks, construction vehicles, and also buses. National security. It's based on a Section 232 investigation, the same tool used for steel and aluminum tariffs. The argument is that reliance on foreign imports for these vehicles and critical parts poses a threat to U.S. military readiness and critical infrastructure resilience.
And the tariff levels.
They are substantial. A 25% ad valorem tariff on those medium and heavy-duty vehicles and key parts. That means 25% of the vehicle's assessed value, plus a 10% tariff on imported buses.
25%. That's a huge price increase for trucking companies, construction firms, anyone using these imported vehicles or parts.
Massive. It's a significant escalation of economic nationalism. It's intended to boost domestic manufacturing. There's even an offset program mentioned for U.S. makers, but the immediate effect will be higher cost.
And the risk of retaliation from other countries.
Very high. Trading partners hit by these tariffs are likely to respond with their own tariffs on U.S. goods, potentially escalating trade disputes. It's a bold protectionist move with significant economic risks.
This projection of strength wasn't just limited to policy documents, though. The White House was also busy on the public diplomacy front, alongside some domestic controversy.
Definitely. Yeah. They made sure to highlight the president's activities. On Tuesday, there were videos promoted showing him participating in a Diwali celebration, important outreach.
And today?
Today, Wednesday the 22nd, he was formally presented with the Architect of Peace Award by the Richard Nixon Foundation. That event got a lot of promotion. The timing, juxtaposed against the shutdown chaos, seemed clearly intentional, portraying him as a successful global leader above the domestic fray.
But that image clashes a bit with the news about the White House ballroom construction. Demolition started Monday on the East Wing.
Yes, crews began work on Monday, October 20th, clearing space for this planned $250 million privately funded grand ballroom project.
Which directly contradicts what the White House previously said about nothing being torn down.
It does. The administration is defending it now, calling it a visionary addition, in line with past presidential modernizations, like the West Wing expansion or even adding the bowling alley. They keep stressing the private funding means no taxpayer cost.
But the scale is different, isn't it? And the criticism is about access, not just aesthetics.
That's the heart of the criticism. Critics are calling it Mar-a-Lago North. They see the private funding not as philanthropy, but as a way for major donors to essentially buy access and influence, creating a space for large events right inside the White House complex itself.
So it's the function and the location during an active presidency, rather than just the cost or the historical precedent of additions.
Precisely. It raises fundamental questions about influence peddling and whether it creates a tiered system of access based on donations right within the official residence and workplace of the president.
Okay, shifting to international finance. Big news confirmed today out of Treasury.
Yes, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent confirmed the U.S. has signed a major $20 billion economic stabilization agreement with Argentina's central bank.
$20 billion. That's a serious commitment. How is the administration framing this?
Bessent was very careful with his wording. He called it a bridge to a better economic future for Argentina, explicitly saying it's not a bailout. The rationale is about stabilizing the Western Hemisphere and, significantly, supporting the reform agenda of Argentina's president, Javier Milei.
But this isn't a simple handout, is it? There are conditions and political pushback here.
It's definitely complex. The funding seems politically tied to Milei's party doing well in upcoming Argentine elections. Essentially, the U.S. is betting on his continued political success to implement the needed reforms.
It was a gamble.
And one that has faced bipartisan criticism in Congress here in the U.S. Some lawmakers are questioning the wisdom of putting $20 billion in taxpayer-backed funds behind a specific, potentially volatile political outcome in another country. Is it stabilization or political intervention? That's the debate.
Let's turn inward now to the structure and workforce of the federal government itself. Because beneath the shutdown drama, there seem to be some really profound changes happening, particularly around staffing levels. Let's start with the Department of the Interior.
Right. A court filing this week brought this to light. Interior disclosed plans for massive reductions in force RIFs. They're planning to cut some 2,050 employees across several key agencies.
2,000 jobs. Where are those cuts concentrated?
They're hitting core functions hard. We're talking about 272 positions at the National Park Service, 335 at the U.S. Geological Survey, that's the main science agency within Interior 143 at Fish and Wildlife Service, and a huge chunk, 474, at the Bureau of Land Management, the BLM.
Are specific regions or functions being targeted?
Yes. The documents show, for example, the NPS Southeast Regional Office is losing nearly a third, 31% of its staff. The USGS Great Lakes Science Center is being decimated. 108 out of 137 staff are slated for elimination.
That sounds like it would cripple scientific monitoring in the Great Lakes.
It certainly raises huge questions about capacity. And out west, BLM offices in key states like Utah, Oregon, Washington, and California are also seeing significant staff reductions.
What's the administration's justification for cuts of this scale, especially hitting scientific and land management roles? Efficiency.
That's the official line. Efficiency, streamlining, reducing redundancy. But critics argue that these aren't redundant positions. These are often highly specialized roles, scientists, resource managers, park rangers, with deep local knowledge.
So cutting them doesn't necessarily make things more efficient.
The argument from critics and many former officials is that it does the opposite in the long run. You lose institutional memory. You lose the expertise needed to manage public lands effectively, to conduct environmental reviews, to understand complex ecosystems. It could actually make the government less efficient and effective at fulfilling its core mission.
We're seeing a similar theme, though, with a different justification, playing out at the IRS regarding their IT systems and layoffs there.
Right. Sam Korkos, who holds roles as Treasury CIO and also represents the Department of Government Efficiency, defended recent RIFs at the IRS. He called them painful but necessary.
Necessary for what?
To finally reboot the agency's stalled IT modernization efforts. His argument is blunt. The current IRS IT workforce largely lacks the modern skills needed, and past attempts failed because the people weren't equipped for the task.
How many jobs are we talking about at the IRS?
The latest round involved about 1,300 RIF notices, mostly hitting HR and IT staff. And this comes on top of significant attrition. The IRS workforce is already down about 25% this year, mostly through people leaving voluntarily.
Korkos basically painted a picture of an agency on the verge of collapse technologically.
He did. He said if the IRS were a private company, it would have been bankrupt years ago due to its outdated systems and inability to serve taxpayers effectively.
But he also highlighted a major problem. The IRS struggles to hire the skilled engineers it needs. Why is that?
Two main reasons he cited: pay and process. Federal salary caps often aren't competitive with what top tech talent can earn in the private sector, and the hiring process itself is often bureaucratic, relying on HR specialists reviewing resumes rather than technical managers assessing actual coding or engineering skills.
So it's catch-22. They need better talent, but struggle to attract it. What's the proposed solution?
Corco's mentioned needing to raise statutory pay caps to even have a chance. He stressed the urgency, pointing to critical projects like modernizing the individual master file, which absolutely needs to be done by fiscal 2028.
This pattern of restructuring, cutting existing staff, trying to reshape the workforce, it seems to extend even to programs designed to bring in top talent, like the Presidential Management Fellowship.
Yes, and this development is deeply concerning to many who value the career civil service. We learned that the regulatory framework for the PMF program was officially abrogated, basically dismantled, through a notice published in the Federal Register this year.
Can you remind listeners what the PMF program is? It's quite prestigious, right?
Extremely. It's widely seen as the federal government's premier leadership development program. It recruits high-achieving individuals with recent advanced degrees, masters, PhDs, JDs, often from top universities, for a 2-year fast-track fellowship designed to cultivate future nonpartisan leaders within federal agencies.
And the official reason for getting rid of it?
The Office of Personnel Management, OPM, notice cited cost savings and efficiency. But, rather ironically, the same notice acknowledged that PMFs represent top talent that is high-achieving and motivated.
That sounds contradictory.
It does, and critics, like former PMF Gary Norman, whose analysis we saw, argue this isn't about saving money. They see it as part of a much broader, deliberate strategy alongside things like the new Schedule F and Schedule G personnel categories to undermine the apolitical, merit-based civil service.
The idea being to replace career experts with political loyalists.
That's the core concern, that this dismantles a key pipeline for independent expertise and makes it easier to install appointees whose primary qualification is loyalty to the administration, rather than subject matter knowledge or experience.
So when you connect the dots, the deep RIFs at Interior, the IRS IT situation, and now eliminating the PMF program, it paints a picture of a concerted effort.
It really does. It looks less like random budget cuts and more like a systematic reshaping of the federal workforce, prioritizing political alignment over traditional civil service norms and expertise. There's already legislative pushback forming, though.
Like what?
Bipartisan efforts are underway to protect these structures. There's talk of the Talents Act, which would actually write the PMF program into law, making it harder to abolish administratively. And the Saving Civil Service Act aims to block attempts to reclassify large numbers of career employees into political appointment categories like Schedule F.
While all this is happening, this workforce turbulence, OPM is also launching a truly massive project to modernize HR systems across the entire government.
It's almost mind-boggling in scale. OPM recently put out a request for proposals, an RFP, looking for a contractor to consolidate. Get this. 119 separate core federal HR systems into one single government-wide commercial system, a software as a service, or SaaS, platform.
119 systems down to one. For how many employees?
For roughly 2 million federal employees. OPM Director Scott Kupor pointed out that managing those 119 disparate legacy systems currently costs an astonishing $5.5 billion a year.
So the potential savings are huge.
Potentially enormous, yes. And the goal is also standardization, efficiency, better management across the board.
What's the timeline for this massive undertaking? And what are the risks?
The timeline is incredibly ambitious. They're targeting a full launch across every agency by July 4th, 2027, a very symbolic date. They hope to award the main contract by December 2025.
And the risks?
Monumental. Migrating data and processes from 119 unique, often ancient systems into a single commercial platform smoothly. It's arguably one of the biggest IT challenges the government has ever attempted. If things go wrong, if deadlines slip, you could be looking at major disruptions to payroll, benefits administration, personnel records. The potential for chaos is significant if not managed perfectly.
Sticking with personnel but shifting to nominations, we saw a pretty high-profile withdrawal this week.
Yes, Paul Ingracia. On Tuesday, October 21st, he withdrew his nomination to be the head of the Office of Special Counsel.
That's the office that protects whistleblowers and enforces rules against prohibited personnel practices. Why did he withdraw?
He cited a lack of necessary Republican support in the Senate. His nomination became deeply controversial following reports about past text messages.
What was in the texts?
The reports alleged he referred to himself as having a Nazi streak, denounced Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and made other racist remarks. Following those reports, both Republican Majority Leader John Thune and the Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer stated publicly that he wouldn't be confirmed. It was a rare bipartisan consensus against a nominee.
So his nomination was dead in the water. Does he leave government now?
No, and this is important. While he withdrew from the Senate-confirmed position, he apparently remains in his current role as a White House liaison to the Department of Homeland Security.
So even if deemed unfit for leadership by the Senate, individuals can sometimes stay in influential, non-confirmed administration roles.
That's often the case, yes. It highlights the difference between roles requiring Senate confirmation and other appointed positions within the executive branch.
On the military side, there was a key nomination sent to the Senate.
Yes. On Monday, October 21st, the Senate received the president's nomination of Army Lieutenant General Christopher LaNeve to be the next Vice Chief of Staff of the Army.
Who is he currently?
He's currently serving as the top military aide to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. He's nominated to replace General James Mingus. This nomination will likely get close scrutiny, especially given the context of recent high-level military retirements and the political dynamics surrounding the Pentagon.
Okay, let's broaden the scope again to national security and international affairs. Vice President J.D. Vance was in Israel over the past couple of days. What was the main takeaway regarding the Gaza ceasefire?
Vance projected cautious optimism about the ceasefire plan itself, the one the administration calls part of its historic peace plan. He said it was going, quote, frankly better than I expected.
But there's a major sticking point.
Yes, Hamas's refusal to disarm. Vance made it clear that this is the main obstacle, and he delivered a very stark warning to Hamas. Cooperate with disarmament or face fast, furious, and brutal force. So the U.S. position remains very firm on that demand.
And what about the future, the reconstruction of Gaza? Any movement there?
We heard from former senior advisor Jared Kushner on this. He stated unequivocally that no reconstruction aid would flow to areas still under Hamas control. Support is conditional on Hamas being removed.
That seems logical, but did he mention anything more concrete?
Yes, significantly. He said that discussions are already underway about potentially starting construction on a new Gaza, but only in those areas that have been secured by the Israeli Defense Forces, IDF.
So not waiting for a full resolution, but perhaps starting rebuilding in cleared zones.
That seems to be the implication. A phased approach, beginning reconstruction where possible, rather than waiting for a comprehensive political settlement for the entire territory.
Switching gears to cybersecurity, a different kind of national security threat. There was news about a breach involving F5.
Yes, the F5 hack. This is a serious concern because F5 provides foundational network security and application delivery technology used very widely, including by many federal agencies and critical infrastructure sectors.
Well, it was stolen.
According to reports, the attackers accessed sensitive data, including source code for F5 products and, crucially, information about undisclosed vulnerabilities 0 days in their systems.
Source code and vulnerability data. That sounds really bad.
Experts are calling it potentially a master key. Having that kind of internal data could allow sophisticated attackers like state-sponsored groups to bypass F5 security measures or craft highly effective targeted attacks against organizations using their technology.
So it creates a huge potential attack surface.
Exactly. It forces a massive scramble for patching and mitigation across government and industry. It really underscores the persistent risks of supply chain security in the tech sector.
On a related note, the military is adapting its own communications tech to deal with modern threats, particularly using satellites.
Right. There's a growing emphasis on the proliferation of low Earth orbit satellite constellations, PLEO. These are seen as a genuine game changer for U.S. military operations.
Why is PLEO so important?
Several reasons. Redundancy, it makes communications much harder to jam or destroy compared to relying on a few large high orbit satellites. Timeliness, it provides near real-time situational awareness. And command and control, or C2, it allows for much better coordination of dispersed forces, including drone swarms and troops operating over vast distances.
Is this about catching up with potential adversaries?
To a large extent, yes. After decades focused heavily on counterinsurgency warfare, the U.S. military is now racing to modernize for potential high-intensity conflicts against peer competitors like Russia and China, who have invested heavily in areas like electronic warfare and long-range missiles. Reliable, resilient C2 through systems like PLEO is absolutely vital for that shift.
Now, amidst all this executive action and legislative paralysis, one branch of government seems to be operating almost normally, the judiciary.
It's a striking contrast, isn't it? The Supreme Court docket, the administrative processes, they've continued completely uninterrupted by the shutdown and the political drama. It really demonstrates that institutional resilience.
We saw some activity in a specific case, Enbridge Energy v. Nestle.
Yes. On Tuesday the 21st, amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs, were filed in that case. It deals with a somewhat technical but important issue, whether federal courts can make equitable exceptions to the strict 30-day deadline for companies to remove a case from state court to federal court.
And who filed briefs supporting Michigan's attorney general, arguing against exceptions?
Two significant groups. First, a coalition of 16 states plus the District of Columbia. Second, a group of tribal nations.
Why would states and tribes weigh in on this procedural rule?
Because it's fundamentally about federalism and state sovereignty. They're arguing that sticking to the strict 30-day deadline protects the authority and integrity of state court systems. Allowing flexible exceptions, they argue, lets large corporations play games, delay proceedings, and undermine state courts. It's states pushing back to preserve their judicial turf.
The Supreme Court was also involved in overseeing executive actions more directly this week.
Yes. On Wednesday, the 22nd, there was a telephone hearing scheduled in that ongoing case, Trump v. Illinois. The hearing was specifically about extending a temporary restraining order, TRO, against certain defendants in the case, though not against the president himself.
So even during a shutdown, the courts are actively managing cases involving the executive branch.
Absolutely. It shows the judiciary acting as that real-time check, ensuring legal processes are followed, regardless of the political situation.
And even the mundane administrative functions carried on.
Completely. Today, the Supreme Court distributed its cases for List 5, paid right on schedule. These are cases the justices will consider in their upcoming conference on November 7th. The basic machinery of justice just keeps grinding forward. It's a powerful symbol of continuity.
Okay, let's wrap up with a couple of other key developments that fall outside the main shutdown fight, but are still really significant politically. First, the dispute over seating Adelita Grijalva in the House.
Right. She won the special election in Arizona, but House Speaker Mike Johnson is still refusing to swear her in.
What's his rationale?
He's tying it directly to the shutdown. He says he'll only seat her when the House comes back for a regular legislative session, which he implies won't happen until Democrats agree to end the shutdown. He's explicitly using her seat as leverage.
And the response from Arizona?
Arizona's Attorney General Chris Mays filed a lawsuit on Tuesday trying to force Johnson to seat Grijalva immediately.
What's the legal argument?
That the speaker's delay is unconstitutional. It denies representation to the roughly 812,000 people in her congressional district. House Democrats are also crying foul, pointing out that Johnson did use brief pro forma sessions to swear in Republicans who won special elections recently. They call it a blatant double standard.
So this is now heading to the courts to decide on the speaker's power versus the right to representation.
Exactly. It's a major constitutional clash over House rules and fundamental representation.
Finally, there was a complex and concerning incident involving immigration enforcement in Los Angeles.
Yes, this happened on Tuesday in South LA. During what officials called a targeted enforcement traffic stop by ICE, an ICE officer fired shots, injuring both a U.S. Marshal who was assisting and the target of the stop.
And the target was identified as someone who streams immigration operations online.
Apparently, yes. Carlitos Ricardo Paredes, who reportedly uses TikTok to document federal immigration activities. He also had apparently escaped custody previously.
What did officials say led to the shooting?
The official account from DHS is that Paredes weaponized his vehicle, hitting law enforcement vehicles during the stop, which prompted officers to fire what they termed defensive shots.
And this immediately became political.
Instantly. Attorney General Pam Bondi used the incident to condemn Democratic proposals for things like an online IC tracker, arguing it puts agents in danger by publicizing their locations or activities. Democrats, in response, highlighted past instances where IC has mistakenly detained U.S. citizens, arguing for more transparency and oversight. It just poured fuel on the already intense immigration debate.
So, pulling it all together from the last 48 hours, this federal news update for Wednesday, October 22nd, really shows the government pulling in opposite directions. You have intense executive action, these big proclamations, the Argentina deal, the workforce RAFs happening against this backdrop of total congressional paralysis, with the shutdown now deep into its fourth week.
And that theme we discussed earlier, the reshaping of the federal workforce, seems undeniable when you look at the interior cuts, the rationale for the IRS layoffs, and especially the move to abrogate the PMF program. It suggests a deliberate effort towards dismantling the traditional nonpartisan civil service structure.
Replacing institutional expertise with potentially political loyalty as the primary value.
That appears to be the direction, yes. It's less about simple efficiency and more about ensuring the bureaucracy aligns with the administration's political goals.
And as we see these efforts to push back, like the proposed Talents Act or the Saving Civil Service Act trying to protect career staff, it really makes you think about that old quote, often attributed to Benjamin Franklin right after the Constitution was drafted. Someone asked him what kind of government they had created.
And he supposedly replied, "A republic if you can keep it."
Exactly. And maybe part of keeping it involves the quality, the independence, the expertise of the people who actually make the government run day to day.
That's the provocative thought to leave you with. How much does the health of that republic depend on the strength and neutrality of its public servants? When you see efforts to dismantle talent pipelines or purge institutional knowledge, what does that mean for the government's ability to solve complex problems long term? Something to definitely consider as you digest all the news from these past 2 days.